Okay, let's get going with this evening's talk, which is, according to the program, it is letting go of letting go, abandoning attachment. And all you yogis who have been meditating the last few days, you've heard me say this again and again and again, to learn how to let go, to abandon things, to let go of attachments. But sometimes you've been trying so hard to let go that you get yourselves all tight, tense and frustrated. And there is an art to letting go. And it's called in this particular talk, letting go of letting go. And for those of you sitting in the back here who are not going to be on this meditation retreat, still learning how to let go is so important in life. Because there's so many problems and difficulties you have. Life is so busy. Even it's a lay life. I told someone today the definition of a lay life, why people are called lay persons, is because they spend a lot of time laying around. Is that true? No, it's not. Maybe it used to be the case, but you have to spend a lot of time working and struggling. So it should really, be called a lay life. It should be called, what, speedy life? Or running around life, or whatever it is. Because very, very busy. And every now and again, that's an imitator there, I'm sure it was an imitator. As you saw. Nah, so yeah. Now, when you are in the world, even you have to let go a lot. Because if you carry too many things around, it gets just too impossible to survive in life. And one of the reasons why there's all these people meditating here today is because when they learn how to let go, they learn this wonderful way of, excuse me, this wonderful way of, see, I let go of you when I attended to the camera, that's important. They learn this wonderful way of actually dealing with the problems and the stress of life. Many people actually in the West, they learn meditation. And they're paid to learn meditation, or the teacher is paid by the company. Because they want their executives not to get heart attacks. It's cost the company a lot of money when their chief executive suddenly sort of collapses and they've got no one to run the business. And also, if you're an executive, this is a cutthroat world. There is great competition out there. If you want to have the edge and survive, you've got to be sharper than your business competitor. Which is why you can come here to Chempaka Buddhist Lodge on this seminar for doing well in life. This is called Wealth Creation Evening. And how do you do this? It's because why is it that a person gets stressed? Some of you have heard this before, but this was a simile from Ajahn Chah, brilliant simile. He held up a cup and said, how heavy is it? And if you don't believe me, you can try this at home. Take up a cup and hold it up in front of you and ask yourself, how heavy is it? The point is, after about 30 seconds, it starts to feel quite heavy. After 1 minute, or maybe 2 minutes, you'll start to ache. In about 5 minutes, you'll even be in pain. And if, as a monk, I continue holding this cup like this for one whole hour, I'd be a hospital case and a very stupid monk. Because what should you do when this starts to get heavy? Put it down. And you can try it at home, hold it out for maybe 2 minutes, put it down for maybe 15 seconds, and lift it up again. It always works. Now it feels lighter. Now this is what we mean by letting go. We put down our burdens. In the world, you don't throw away your burdens forever, unless you want to become an arahant, fully enlightened, and leave the world. But each one of us can learn how to put down our burdens just for a short time in order for us to rest. When we've rested for a short while, we can pick up the burden again, and it's easy to carry. It actually feels lighter. In fact, it's exactly the same amount of water in this cup. The reason it feels lighter is because my arm has rested. The reason why you can cope with a heavy burden in your business, in your life, is not because you lessen the number of duties you have. It's because you know how to put them down from time to time to rest, so that afterwards you can carry them with ease. Now, some of you may know me for many years, and some of you may know that I must have done some terrible, terrible bad karma in the past, because I have to work so hard in this life. My favorite saying is, no peace for the wicked. And I'm supposed to be good, so I don't know what the wicked have to do. It must be terrible. Because I work very, very hard. I'm the spiritual... Well, let's see. All of my duties. I am the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of West Australia, the abbot of a big monastery, very successful, also looking after this huge nuns' monastery, 583 acres, with lots of nuns there, in Western Australia. Spiritual director of the Buddha Dhamma Hermitage, just south of Sydney. A spiritual patron of Bodhikusuma Meditation Centre in Sydney. The spiritual advisor of the Buddhist Society of Victoria. The spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of South Australia. The patron of the Thamkopok Foundation in Thailand. The spiritual patron of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. And that's only a starter. So, I am a very, very busy monk. Because one time I was giving a talk in Singapore, and when I talk like I do about all these lovely little pieces of Dhamma and strategies for life, at question time this young man stood up and said, Ajahn Brahm, that all makes sort of sense, but I guess it only works in the monastery. These sorts of things you can't put into practice in the business world. It's all right for you because you don't have to do so much. I said, hang on, mate. I said, what do you mean I don't have to do so much? And so I just recounted just what I'd done that day, getting up at 4 o'clock. This was even when I was on teaching tour. And then getting ready for the day, writing letters, because people give me all this stuff to do. You know, just read something, look at something, write a letter for something or other. And I've got to do that in my spare time. Which means when I first get up in the morning before I come down here. So I have to do all of that. And then from the first time which you go out to have your breakfast, it's not really breakfast. Even before you go and sit at the table, people are asking you the questions. And then once they start asking you questions, it doesn't stop until late at night. And even late at night, after you've given a public talk, somebody drives you home and you're just so tired. And what do they do in the car? Oh, can I ask a question? So it gets so much work. When I describe all the work I'd done that day, which is an average day, the man who actually stood at the microphone said, wow, I never thought you worked so hard. He said, you know, I always wanted to be a monk sometime, but now I think I'll stick to being a computer programmer. So it is hard work. But I learned very early on how to let go. So I said that's all those things I'm supposed to be doing. But when I came overseas, when I left Australia, I did not bring my monastery with me. I don't know what's going on over there, and I don't care, because when I'm there, then I'm the abbot. When I'm here, standing in front of you, I'm the teacher of this meditation retreat. When I leave next Sunday evening, I'll leave you all behind. I will not take you as cabin baggage. And that's I let go all the time. Even, you know that some of you have come into the interview time, into the interview period, and you've told me some of your deepest personal problems. And you've talked to me, and I've given you counseling. You know that sometimes that people who do counseling get very drained. Sometimes in those afternoons, it's 30 slots. I talk to 30 people in the afternoon. If I was a real counselor and being paid, I'd make a fortune. But you're not in it for the money, you're in it for the happiness. But also, how can you do that? Because I practice letting go when we do counseling. And the way you do letting go when you're counseling is this. You are a dustbin when you are a counselor. Your job is not to sit there and give advice. Your job is to sit there and accept all the rubbish. All the problems about their husband, all the problems about their wife, all the problems about their past, all the problems about their finances, all the problems about their children, all the problems. It's always problems, problems, problems. And it's always people tell me the problems about their marriage, their children, their finances. I became a monk to get rid of all of that, and now you're dumping it on me again. But I don't mind, I'm very happy. So all you need to do is be a dustbin. Say, okay, I'm open, bung it all in. And so they tell me all the problems. It's nice to be able to tell someone a problem, because you know why? Because when you're telling someone else, you're listening yourself. You're listening to what you're saying. That's one of the greatest things of a counselor, of a listener, to give the opportunity for people to bring out their feelings, to express them, and to listen to them while they're saying it. And they learn. That's one of the greatest things to do. But as soon as somebody has finished, they dumped all of their problems on me. I always remember my teacher's great advice. He was just so smart, Ajahn Chah. Because he said that as a monk, you're a counselor. You have to listen to other people's problems. But always remember this. If you're going to be a counselor, you have to be a dustbin. But be a dustbin with a hole on the bottom. So in other words, you don't keep anything. You allow people to tell you their problems. You receive everything, but you allow it to flow right through you. You don't keep anything. You let it go. You allow it to flow through you. Because the trouble with counselors, and we're all counselors to our loved ones or to our friends, is we tend to keep too much. And when we keep it, we attach to it. That's why even counselors can become very depressed. Even the counselors can need counseling. But if you know how to be a dustbin, you can receive everything. And because after you've just talked with one person, because you don't keep anything, your dustbin is never too full to listen to somebody else. Isn't that wonderful? You can actually listen to someone who's just, you know, on the edge, just of despair, of loneliness, frustration, don't know what to do. And you can actually listen to them. And when they're finished, you can be so fresh to listen to the next person without a pause. That is called letting go. And this is important in life, to be able to do this, to be able to be friends to each other, allow people to tell us their problems, and to help them in that way. There's no end of problems. So if anybody has their problems, you can always come and dump them here. What we mean there is actually learning how to let go, not to keep things. You can understand what attachment is when you keep things, you keep accumulating things in life. I'm not saying about accumulating wealth, I'm accumulating all the bad experiences of life. Why is it that when we look upon our past, we only remember the bad experiences, what happened to us? I said that the first talk I gave you, the first evening. You remember the story of the chicken farmer who went to the shed in the morning and only... Did I tell that story here? I didn't tell a story here. Okay, please excuse me, it's a bit coarse in the language, but it only works if I use this, you know, slightly coarse language. There was a chicken farmer, and in the morning, he went to the chicken shed to collect what the chickens had done the night before. He went into the shed with his bucket and collected all the chicken shit and left the eggs to rot. That was a very stupid chicken farmer. He just collected the dung. The second chicken farmer went into the chicken shed and he collected the eggs. He left all the chicken shit in there to rot. That was a smart chicken farmer. In this simile, collecting the shit, the dung, is collecting all the bad stuff which has happened to you today or in your life. Why do you collect that and leave all the eggs, the good stuff, to rot? If you're a smart chicken farmer or a smart person, you'll just remember all the wonderful experiences you've had so far, and you'll leave all the rotten stuff in the shed. So, which type of chicken farmer are you? Do you understand what I'm saying there? Too often, when we really should be letting go of the bad stuff, we let go of all the good things which have happened to us, all the wonderful experiences which we've had, and the one rotten thing which happens to us today, that's what we collect, and we take home to our wife. Oh, something terrible happened to me today, wife. Now, why is it we do that? We attach to the wrong things, and we let go of the wrong things. Sometimes people tell me, but Ajahn Brahm, you learn from your mistakes. Why is it we collect our mistakes? And why is it we collect the mistakes of other people? Because we're not wise. Instead of collecting the mistakes, I collect the successes, my own and other people. And I found through experience, you learn not from your mistakes, as well as you learn from your successes. So learn from your successes in life. Bring them up to the front, like the eggs which you've laid last night. I'm metaphorically speaking, that is. And collect those. All your mistakes, the silly things you've done, leave them where they were, and don't bring them back into the house. This is what we mean by letting go. We learn from our successes. We collect our successes. All the wonderful things which your wife has done, which your husband has done, which your children has done, which your parents have done, which I have done. You remember those, not the mistakes. A good example of this. When I was in Malaysia a couple of years ago, I was giving a talk at one of the universities. I forget where it was, somewhere. I think just quite outside of KL somewhere. I forget where it was. But anyway, I was giving the talk, and question time afterwards, someone asked a question. It was a woman, maybe in her mid-20s, and she said, "I'd like to seek your advice, Ajahn Brahm. I've just caught my husband lying to me. I can't trust him anymore. Shall I get divorced?" That's what she asked me. So, being a scientist, I wanted to be objective about this. So first of all, I gathered some more data. I said, "Madam, what are you doing in this university?" And she said, "I'm a lecturer." "Oh, what are you lecturing in?" "Mathematics." And I saw my chance. I said, "Okay, let's do some statistics. How long have you been married to your husband?" I said, "About 3 years." "Okay, let's call that 1,000 days, give or take a few days here or there. Now let's assume, for the sake of this argument, that your husband, on average, has said 20 things to you every day, on average, which could be right or wrong. 20 statements per day. That's pretty reasonable, which could be right or could be wrong. So that's, in all the time you've been married, that's 20,000 things he's said to you, which could be right or wrong. And now you've found he's made a mistake and he's lied to you. According to probability theory, that means the next time he says something, it's 20,000 to 1 he's telling the truth. To me, that's trustworthy, 20,000 to 1. So why are you wanting to get divorced? The 20,000 things he said, and now he's made his first lie. What do you mean you can't trust him? When you put it that way, isn't that reasonable, isn't that logical? That's a trustworthy person. You can trust them if you know 20,000 to 1 they're telling the truth. But why is it that they tell one lie and we want to get divorced? We think we can't trust them anymore. The reason is because we let go, we take for granted, we abandon, we don't even think about all the wonderful, the good things, the truthful things he said. And all we remember is the one lie. Now we're letting go of the wrong things. Why is it that we attach to negativity, to the faults? You've heard that story, the bad bricks in the wall. Why do we only see the bad bricks and not the good bricks? Why do we only see the lie and not the truthful things? Why do we always see the mistakes in life, not the wonderful things in life? Because we let go of the wrong thing. We attach to the wrong thing. So part of life, part of wisdom, is learning how to let go of what is worthy of letting go of. And attaching and keeping what's worthy of keeping. Just like the chicken farmer only keeps the eggs. When you know what that really means, you know, when I talk about letting go, it's not letting go of everything. Sometimes people in places like Australia, in Western countries, come up to me and challenge me. They said, Ajahn Brahm, you're a monk. I said, yeah, I'm a monk. He said, you should let go some more. What do you mean, I am letting go? You should let go and wear a suit and go and see a movie and drink and have sex. Let go. Oh my goodness. What do you mean you're letting go? I am letting go. He said, you should let go. Let me go. Get lost. So, because sometimes people don't understand what letting go is and what attachment is. This is what it is. In your life, there's always some little degree of attachment, some degree of letting go. It's like climbing a ladder. When you climb a ladder, you have to attach to the rung above you to pull yourself up. And you have to let go of the rung underneath you to pull yourself up. There comes a time, later on in your journey, the rung which you were holding on to before, now you're standing on. Now is the time to let go of that. If you let go of all the rungs, especially when you're halfway up the ladder, you know what's going to happen. You're going to slide down and get a great injury. So you have to be sensible about this, wise about what to let go of and what to attach to. A very good example of this is a story which I wrote in my book, which is a practical lesson in letting go in daily life, especially for those of you who are in business. Because this was a story of the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. And this was a time, about, was it 35 years ago, more than that, was 38 years ago, during the Six-Day War in the Middle East, when Israel was at war with Jordan, Syria, Egypt, I forget who else was involved there. But there was this huge war in the Middle East. It was named afterwards the Six-Day War, although some people said afterwards it wasn't a Six-Day War because it still hasn't finished. And at that time, someone interviewed Harold Macmillan. I think he had just retired as a Prime Minister, but he's still like an elder statesman. And someone probably like Lee Kuan Yew or something. They went over there to ask him like advice. So the newspapers interviewed this famous man, an ex-Prime Minister, a statesman, and said, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East? This was during the war. And without hesitation, he said, sir, there is no problem in the Middle East. And the reporter couldn't understand that answer. What do you mean there is no problem in the Middle East? There's a war going on as we speak. People are dying. Houses, infrastructure is being blown to smithereens by the tanks. It's a crisis there. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? And quite calmly, this former British Prime Minister said, sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it can't be a problem. Now that's as Buddhist as you can get. That's brilliant. Now that truly is wisdom. Because if you are in a position of responsibility, like being a Prime Minister, or being a boss of a company, or just being like a breadwinner of a family, or being a mother, or whatever else, or being an abbot of a monastery. You can't afford to waste time on things which haven't got a solution. Why not put all your effort and energy where you can be effective on things which have a solution? In other words, with real problems. A problem is something with a solution. It's something where you can be effective. So why waste time where you cannot be effective? Basically, if you look at the situation, you can do nothing about it. It is not a problem. Do you understand what we mean there? When there's nothing to do, you do nothing, you let go. When there's something to do, you give it everything you've got. If it's a problem, you really put your effort into making the solution happen. There's nothing you can do about it. That's when you let go. So that wonderful saying by the Prime Minister was actually telling you how to live your life, how to perform responsibly in this world when you are in positions of authority. Figure out whether there's something you can do. If you can't do it, leave it alone. It's not a problem anymore. Don't even worry about it. Think about it. Because if you're worrying about and thinking about things with no solution, you're not being effective where you really can make a difference. So what does that mean to your daily life? It means if someone has died, is it a problem? Of course it isn't. They're dead. You can't bring them back. So it's not a problem anymore. Is that true? If you got the sack, you've lost your job and there's no way of getting it back again. Is it a problem? It's not a problem because there's no solution. If you've got terminal cancer, is that a problem? It's not a problem because there's no solution. Why worry about things which you cannot change? So here we learn about what letting go is. We learn to let go of things which we can't do nothing about. Unfortunately, the suffering of human beings is not realizing that there's so many things they worry about, they struggle with, are things without solutions. And all they do is get themselves more and more tense, more and more uptight, more and more sick. They create more problems. So here we understand what letting go is. If we can only learn that lesson, we become far more efficient in life, far more effective, far more successful, far more happy. Look at when somebody says something to you which is really rude and abusive. They've said it already. You can't do anything. It's gone. Talking about chickens, did I tell you about the ceremony to make amends when you said something awful to your wife, the chicken plucking ceremony? Did I tell you that one? Or was that in Singapore? Because once upon a time, there was a man who came to a monk. He had a problem. What had happened that evening, he'd said something really mean to his wife. He'd really upset her by calling her a terrible name. And she was mad at him for doing that. So he came out of his house and he went to the monk for advice. What can I do? Can you perform some magic ceremony to undo the harm which I've done? So I said something awful to the one I love, to my wife. And I wish I hadn't said it. Can you sort of do some ceremony to magic it away? And he said, actually there is a ceremony. It's called the chicken ceremony. It's a very secret rite in Buddhism. Have you ever had any monk here do the chicken ceremony for you? Well, this is what it is. The monk said, for this very powerful ritual, I will need a chicken. You have to have a chicken for the chicken ceremony. So he said, what I want you to do, there's still time, go to the market, buy a dead chicken. And to save time, on the way home, or on the way to the temple from the market, pluck all the feathers out of the chicken, because I need it sort of without feathers. So the man did what he was told. He didn't know why. He went to the market, bought a dead chicken. On the way back to the temple, he plucked all the feathers out and he gave it to the monk when he got there. So he handed the monk this plucked dead chicken. And the monk said, "Very good. Now for part two of this ceremony, you have to come early in the morning." So he went home. The monk put the chicken in the refrigerator. And the following morning, the man came to see him. And the monk got the chicken out of the refrigerator and said, "Okay, the way we can actually absolve your bad karma for saying that rotten thing to your wife is this. Now you have to walk back to the market on exactly the same path you came last night. Collect all the feathers and stick them back on the chicken where they came from." He said, "I can't do that. I probably won't even be able to find all the feathers, let alone stick them back again. Once they're plucked out of the chicken, they're gone." And the monk said, "Yes. Once the words come out of your mouth, you can't catch them and put them back again." And that was the meaning of the chicken ceremony, to teach that man that once those words come out of your mouth, you can't put them back again. So, it's much better to make sure they don't come out in the first place. So this is actually why we can learn to actually let go of our anger and don't get upset. Or actually don't say things which upset another person first of all. But actually on the other chicken story, I'm not sure if I told this one about how to deal when someone's angry at you. About going to the market and getting the eggs. Did I tell that here? 2 days ago, okay. About the crazy man. Yeah, okay. So I won't tell that one again. I'll let that one go. But just for those of you who haven't heard the story, just in brief, the Buddha was saying that anyone who gets angry at you is crazy. So why is it that when someone's angry at us, why don't we let it go? If someone calls you an idiot, if someone calls you a dog, if someone calls you, was it camel face, what I said last night? Why do we get angry at them? Why do we get mad? Why do we hate them? There's two reasons. First of all, we believe them. If you didn't believe them, would you ever get angry at them? Someone calls you camel face, you say, "I'm sorry, you're wrong. I'm not a camel, I'm a monk." So why do we get angry? It's because we don't know who we are. We haven't got that self-confidence. We believe what other people say. And because of that, we've got no self-confidence. We can't let things go. So that's why we're letting it go. They call you a name, you forget about it. The other way, the reason why we get angry, it's because we keep thinking about it. We don't let go of the memory of the abuse. She called me camel face. She's got no right to call me camel face. Why did she call me camel face? And you've already called yourself camel face 3 more times. There were these 2 Australian veterans from the Second World War. Were meeting at a reunion. They started talking about their time in the Second World War. Both had been POWs under the Japanese. Both had had very unpleasant times, seeing many of their friends tortured and killed, and even receiving torture themselves. That was a very traumatic time for many people. In their reunion, one of those ex-POWs asked the other, "Do you still hate those Japanese, those prison guards, who killed and tortured so many of our friends?" He said, "Yes, mate. I can never forgive what those people did. What about you?" He said, "I forgave those guards years ago. That's why I'm no longer in the POW camp. You still are in that camp. Do you understand?" Why can't we let go of the abuse. When you don't let go of the abuse, when you don't let it go, you still allow yourself to suffer. You're still in the prison of your past. You still allow whoever abused you to carry on abusing you. When you actually understand that saying, or that the meaning of what I just said, it's a very, very powerful teaching for you to let go of what happened in the past. Why? So you can be free in the present moment. So that you can walk on into the future with success. Too often we are prisoners of our past. And that prison has a door which is wide open. We don't have to stay inside. We can walk out any time we have the courage to do so. It takes courage to forgive, which is why monks like me give encouragement to say, yes, it's possible to do it. Many people have. Walk out and be free. And these are letting go of things which are really important to let go of. If we don't let go of these ordinary things in life, how on earth can we be happy? It's in your interest, your family's interest, your loved one's interest, your business interest, your nation's interest, and it's certainly in my interest for you to let go so you don't keep bothering with me with all your complaints and arguments and suffering and stuff like that. I want to be free as well. I want an easy life, so please let go. So, this is letting go of the past. Letting go of the future. And then you're free in the present moment. You can enjoy the moment, which has got lots of enjoyment. And those of you who've been meditating, I've been teaching you this all the time. To learn how to let go. So what do? You sit down there and say, let go. I'm ordering you, let go. Let go or else. Now, of course, that is not letting go. That's doing something. That's controlling. For those of you who have got deep understanding of Buddhism, there is a person, a character, a being in Buddhist cosmology who's pretty equivalent to the Christian idea of a devil. You know that name? Mara, yeah. Mara, the tempter. He's a bad guy in Buddhist cosmology. Where does Mara live? He lives in this realm, which in Pali is called the Parinimitta Wasawati realm. The realm of those who wield mastery or control over others' creations. He is a control freak. The control freak in chief. The one who gets off on power or on control. Have you ever heard that saying, power corrupts? Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Control corrupts. He's the opposite of the Buddha, who doesn't control. What's the opposite of controlling? Let go, yeah. So every time you yogis start to try and do some controlling, start to make yourself let go, start to control your breathing, your meditation, you are acting under the influence of Mara. Mara has got you by the neck. And it's shaking you around all over the place. How do you stop that? In Buddhism, there's many, many examples of this character, Mara, trying to confront the monks, the great arahats, or the Buddha himself. And you know how the Buddha defeated Mara? He didn't attack him. All he would do was say, I know you, Mara. And the Mara would say, the monk knows me, the monk knows me. And would slink away, disappointed, frustrated, depressed. That's all one needed to do to defeat the controller. To know Mara. So when you are meditating and you start to control, know that as Mara has come into your meditation and has stopped you letting go. here in our meditation, we want freedom from letting go. So don't do the letting go. Allow it to happen. This is actually how it works in meditation. You let go, stage, it works in meditation. You let go stage by stage. There's a simile in meditation, or in Buddhism, called the simile of the lotus. The lotus is a very ubiquitous, means it's in many traditions, it's a very famous simile or metaphor in Buddhism. Especially in Tibetan Buddhism, there is a mantra called Om Mani Padme Hum. Do you know what that means? It means like homage to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The jewel is the mani. Padme is in the heart of the lotus. Do you know what that jewel is? I'm going to tell you now. Imagine a 1,000-petaled lotus. That 1,000-petal, you see many lotus is, or loti, whichever you want, many lotuses in the lakes and the ponds or the rivers here in Malaysia, you notice that that lotus closes up at night. In the morning, when the sun rises, the warmth of the sun hits the outermost petals of the lotus. When it warms them up, the lotus opens, but only the outermost petals. Okay? Because the outermost petals open, it gives the chance for the next layer of petals to receive the warmth from the sun. So the next layer of petals opens up, which gives a chance for the sun to warm the next layer of petals. Layer after layer after layer opens up, as long as the warmth of the sun stays put. If a cloud comes up and obscures the sunshine and it gets cold, all those petals all close up again. Now, what does that mean with meditation, with actually the path of the Buddha? What it means is the sun stands for your mindfulness, your attention. All you need to do is be attentive. To know, you don't open up that lotus by taking your fingers and peeling the petals off one by one. You do not do this. You'll just spoil and damage the lotus. You just have to wait. How long does it take for a petal to open? Who knows? The petal decides when to open, not you. Your job is just to make sure the sun keeps on falling on that lotus petal you're experiencing now. Your job is just to be mindful of what you're experiencing now and let it alone. Let the sunshine of mindfulness do the business. And then what happens? When you're letting go, then you're still. When you're still, the lotus opens up by itself. When you do something, for those of you who've got into deep meditation, those of you who might have seen a nimitta, wow, a nimitta, bang, 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 they all close up. And you miss it all because you did something. The sunshine went away. The mindfulness was lost. The stillness was ruined. What letting be means, or letting go, is allowing mindfulness just to play on your mind. You don't have to have a powerful mind, a great experience. Have you ever noticed the outermost petals of the lotus are very rough, weather-worn, even dusty and dirty? Just like you. Weather-worn, dusty. Doesn't matter, because inside you, inside that weather-worn, dusty, very unpromising lotus you call your body and mind, in everybody's lotus, there is this beautiful jewel in the heart, the Buddha nature in the heart of you. So as you're mindful, just aware, not doing anything, but just staying still, the lotus opens up, stage by stage, all by itself. First of all, the outermost petals open out, revealing the next layer inside of them. They open out, revealing the next layer inside of that. Have you heard me say already, the next stage of meditation is right within the stage you're in now? You don't move anywhere. You stay put and go deeper into the experience you have now. You don't move to another lotus. This experience, whatever it is always good enough. If you stay on this experience, it opens up by itself. Sometimes you have what you think the most unpromising meditation. You think this can't work, but inside the worst state of mind is the most beautiful of lotus petals. It just peels open. Because you are still, the lotus opens out. As you go deeper into the lotus, you go into stages like silent or present moment awareness, silence, watching the beautiful breath, even the nimitta, this beautiful light which is in the heart of the lotus. That opens out by itself. If you get excited, it all closes up again. You've got to be at still. The sunshine has got to warm everything. And too many people asking, what should I do next? You don't do anything next. That's like throwing away the lotus you've got now and looking for the one next to it. You just stay put. Staying put is called letting go. Letting it be. Leaving it alone. It's the effortless meditations called stillness. And as you just allow mindfulness, bare attention, non-doing looking, to keep gazing, then that lotus opens up even more deeply. You always notice the most fragrant, delicate, beautiful petals of a lotus are the ones inside. The deeper you go, the more fragrant are those petals, the more beautiful, more colourful, more delicate they are. Just like the deeper you go into your mind, the more beautiful and delicate it becomes. The nimitta, this beautiful light which comes up, is amazing. And if that nimitta opens out, in the middle of that nimitta, just like the lotus petal opens, you find the wonderful first jhana. When that opens out, like the beautiful gossamer petals, it opens up to reveal the next layer, the second jhana. The third, fourth jhana. The first immaterial jhana, second, third, fourth immaterial jhana. And that holds in its middle. This is the last layer of petals, as you're going right into the heart of the mind. The center of you. The middle. Where you come from. When that petal opens up, you finally see the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The wonderful thing which we celebrate with that Om Mani Padme Hum chant. And you know what that jewel is? You know what it looks like? You know why they pay homage to it? Because when that last layer of petals opens out, you see at last the Dhamma which the Buddha saw. The jewel in the heart of the lotus. Which is, do you want to know? Do you really want to know? It's emptiness, there's nothing there. That's why it is the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The most amazing, beautiful emptiness of anatta. All that is so delightful. Because when you know there is nobody here, then you can really let go. You can really let it be. When someone calls you camel face, who are they calling camel face? No one in here to be camel face. Is it my face? Is it my body? Is it my feelings, my perceptions, my mental formations, my consciousness? There's nobody in here. So why is it you are striving so hard when there's no one in here? Now this is one of the problems of people. Because we don't understand the Dhamma, we don't actually let go of things. We just keep grasping other things. Many years ago, when I was a young monk, I was told you had to let go. So what did I do? I became a monk, I let go of girls. And then what happened next? I started attaching to food. When you become a young monk, or a young novice, food becomes very important to you. You eat a lot. You know why a person is called a novice when they become a young monk? That's right, no vice. That's what called novice. So anyway, food became... So what I'd done, I'd given up sex, but I've actually started attaching to food. So I said, put down the food, let it go. And then I started getting attached to something else. Have you ever noticed in life, whenever you let go of one thing, you pick up another thing? So I couldn't do this letting go business. I remember this was one monk, I saw him when we were eating our morning meal. He had his bowl full of food, and he was looking at it, contemplating his meal. And then he pushed it away. He said, I saw I was greedy, so I decided to overcome the greed, I pushed my food away. Then he contemplated a bit more and said, that's just pride, so he pulled his food towards him. Then he looked again and said, that's greedy, he pushed his food away. That's pride, pulled it towards him. He was pushing the food backwards and forwards. Because as soon as you let go of something, you attach to something else. And that's one of our problems. As soon as you let go of your wife, you pick up another girl. That's not the way. The reason is because we've got an attacher, a self. That's what a self does. It always picks things up. As soon as there's a you there, there'll always be an attachment. That is one of the problems with actually letting go. The deep problems. The reason you will always pick things up, you always grasp, is because there's someone to do the grasping. Now I'm getting into deep teachings here. I figured out as a young monk, the reason I keep picking things up with my hand is because that's what a hand does. This is the function of a hand, to pick things up. So the only way I can stop picking things up is what? Cut off my hand. That's the only way to stop picking things up, to cut off your hand. So I thought that's the only way to really let go, to cut off the self. Because that's what a self does, it attaches. When we look at attachment, grasping in Buddhism, we only think of the object of attachment. Being attached to girls, being attached to boys, being attached to family, being attached to money, being attached to possessions. What we never do is actually to look at this end of attachment. What's doing the attaching? When we look at that, we see it's our sense of self. Who you think you are. That is a big problem in life. When we have a sense of self, we will always do lots of attaching. The bigger the sense of self we have, the more we will attach. Big egos control lots of things. This is why letting go of controlling, is actually letting go of yourself. So when you go into deep meditation, not just letting go of attachments, you're also letting go of the thing doing the attaching. You. Why do you attach to things? It's only more pain and more suffering in life. I told a few people when they've been meditating here, why can't you live like a bird? Especially when you're meditating, maybe when you're working in the world, you have to pick things up, but when you're meditating, be like a bird. Because I've watched birds in the sky for many years, and I've never seen yet a bird carrying suitcases. But when you go from place to place, even those of you who live in KL, just down the road, how many suitcases and bags have you brought here? Let alone if you come from Singapore or come from overseas. Why do we carry? And every time you carry so much, it's just so heavy. I have a great time as a monk. You see me when I go from place to place. Those of you who met me at the airport just got my bowl and my little bag here. That's all I have. So it's great, your first one through the customs. Because you don't have to wait by the carousel. It's wonderful being a monk. Because you can be like a bird. When you have no attachments, when you don't carry so much around with you, you can fly very easily through life. Now do you understand how you can fly very easily through this meditation retreat? What baggage have you brought into this retreat with you? All of your past, all of your family, all of your shares. Have you heard what's happened to the stock market since we started this retreat? Do you want to know? Can't we let go of these things from time to time? You see, I've got all those responsibilities, but I never take my responsibilities with me. When I'm in Perth, I'm the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, when I'm in their headquarters. When I leave there to go back to my monastery, and then I'm the abbot. When I go to New South Wales, I'm the spiritual patron of Bodhicrisma, the hermitage. When I leave there to go to Singapore, I'm the patron of the Buddhist Fellowship. But when I leave those places, I leave those duties as well. I don't worry about things. Have you ever noticed when you don't worry about things, that things go quite much better? When we try and control things, they go much worse. Have you ever noticed when the traffic lights go out, there's electrical failure, the traffic flows much more freely? It's true, because when you don't control things, things go much, much better. And it's the same. Somebody told me this. In Jerusalem, in Israel, oh, it was Tel Aviv, I think, sorry. The doctors went on strike in all the main hospitals. They went on strike for about a couple of weeks. During those couple of weeks, the research showed afterwards that the death rate went down. There's no doctors about. It's strange, isn't it? When we control things, things go much worse. When we let go, they go better. So can't we learn how to not carry so... Why is it they go better? Because we carry burdens, we get stressed. So why worry about these things anyway? When you let go of worry, let go of the future. The future is so uncertain. You never know what's going to happen next. You know that story I told about how you can let go of the future because the future is so uncertain? When one of the Ajahn Chah's disciples tricked him into telling his fortune. Did I tell that story here a few days ago? You know, with the lions, your future is uncertain, never wrong. So why worry about the future? You don't know what's going to happen. So it means you can let go of the future, you can let go of the past, you can let go of all of your relations and family when you are here. That way you've got less burdens, less things to worry about. You're more free, you're more at peace. This is what we mean by letting go. However, it's hard to do this because people do the letting go. That's why I wrote on this title of the talk, Letting Go of Letting Go. Because we try too hard to let go. And because we're doing the letting go, it never happens. So we've got to be very sneaky, just like watching that lotus, to be able to let go of letting go. One of the wonderful ways of doing this is actually comes from the idea of measurement. This idea came to me because somebody reminded me of one of the great engineers, one of the founders of science, who was in England in maybe 17th or 18th century, a fellow called Lord Kelvin. Many of the great scientists were also philosophers. And for those of you who've done engineering, you'll know that Lord Kelvin has his name immortalized in that standard of temperature called the Kelvin scale, which goes to absolute zero. And they always say like degrees Kelvin. If there's any physicists or engineers here, you know what I'm talking about. But one of the great sayings of the philosopher Lord Kelvin, which actually meant so much to engineering and technology, was that if you want to control the world, you have to learn how to measure accurately. So the Industrial Revolution in Britain and modern technology was all predicated, all based on learning to have accurate standard measurements. And once we sorted out our measurements, then technology, which is the control of our environment, started to happen. Measurement came first, control came afterwards. Any engineers here would understand what I'm talking about. But I turned that around. What happened? Any engineers here would understand what I'm talking about. But I turned that around. What happened if you don't measure? Then you won't be able to control. All control starts with measuring. So a wonderful way of letting go is stopping all this measuring. Who's the best meditator in this room? Who's the worst meditator in this room? I think most of you identify with the latter rather than the former. How can you measure yourself? Was your last meditation a good meditation or a bad meditation? Why do you measure these things? Can you really say there's a good meditation or a bad meditation? How about stopping all this good and bad measuring? When you stop measuring in terms of good and bad, you'll understand what we mean by this is good enough. Or if you really like, this is bad enough. Whichever way, when you stop measuring, how can you aspire for anything? How can you reach out for anything? When you stop measuring, there's an automatic letting go. Really, do you know what is a good meditation or a bad meditation? My first teacher told me there's no such thing as a bad meditation. So that way, are you ever disappointed? Of course not. When you don't compare yourself to other people, you're not measuring yourself against others. Are you not free of ego? The problem with human beings is we measure ourselves against others. From the time we're in school, who's the smartest, who's the prettiest, who's the strongest? We get into competition. And that competition, when we measure ourselves against others, that gives rise to a lot of suffering. Especially when we measure, we have competition, we're always trying to prove ourselves. And because we're proving ourselves, we're always trying to impress. I found out something very wonderful when I was a young monk. I heard this saying, which was so true to life. And it was one of these sayings which got rid of so much suffering in my life. It said that when you're in your 20s, you're very concerned what other people think of you. And it's very true. You look at any young people here, they have to have smart hairstyles, good fashion, designer clothes. They speak in this youth speak, which adults don't understand at all. It's cool. Girls want to be pretty. Boys want to be smart. They're always really concerned what other people think of you. When you're in your 40s, I think you can appreciate this. You get what's called self-confidence. You don't care what other people think of you. You've got confidence. When you're in your 60s, you finally find out that people weren't thinking about you anyway. They're all thinking about themselves. So wasn't that wonderful to find out when you're young that people don't think about you, they all think about themselves. So that means you can let go of trying to impress somebody else. Stop measuring yourself. Just be yourself. You can let go. So when we don't try and be successful, then we are successful. When we don't try to impress, we are impressive because we relax and be ourselves. When you don't try to be successful in meditation, then meditation is successful. Now do you understand what letting go is all about? Stop doing all this struggling business. Allow yourself to be. Allow the moment to be. Allow the meditation. Stop measuring it all the time. When there's no measuring, there's nothing to do. There's nowhere to go. When you don't measure or compare, there's an actual letting go. All time. How long have we been going in this talk? just one moment, because I'm not measuring the time. Is this a good talk or a bad talk? Are the people in the back going to stand up with these little cards? 5, 4, 2, like in the Olympic Games? No. Am I going to give you a report card at the end of this retreat? No. Those of you who have been in the interviews, have I criticized you? Have I measured your progress? Whatever you said to me, my meditation is terrible, I've been sleeping all the time. I said, well done, excellent. Some people have said they've got these wonderful limiters. I said, well done, excellent. I haven't been measuring you at all, because I've been letting you go, freeing you. Too often we put so many constraints upon ourselves, we hinder our progress. Your progress, you are just like little flowers, little seedlings. You're growing at your own rate. And my job is to protect you, to leave you alone, to let nature happen, to let the sunshine open up your lotus to see your jewel in the heart, to see the source of things. That's my job, is just to cultivate you. But my first teacher, meditation teacher, told me that when he was very young, in Thailand, his father gave him seeds to plant in the garden. He was only about 6 or 7 years of age. So he put those seeds in the garden and he watered them every day. After 1 week, he was only about 6 or 7 years of age, he became very impatient because he couldn't see anything happening. He asked his father, said, Father, I've been watering them for 6 days and nothing's happening, they've all died. If I said, no son, they've germinated, they're probably growing under the ground, but you can't see them. Just like many of you, you've been coming to the interview and say, nothing is happening, I've been sleepy since the time I came here, my mind has been restless, and I'm trying to tell you, there's a seed growing inside there, it's almost at the surface, you're going to see something happening soon. Let it go. And fortunately, he believed his father. I hope you believe me and stop messing around. And sure enough, the next day he saw a little seedling coming above the ground, a little green shoot. He was so excited he watered it twice a day. Just like you, when you start really getting some results in the meditation, you get here early in the morning, late at night, you really want to get into it. Water it twice a day. And sure enough, it grew, grew, grew. It was about 2 inches high. When he really lost his patience, he decided to stretch the flowers to make them grow quicker. He stretched every flower to try and make it grow quicker, and he killed every one of them. Do not stretch your meditation. Do not try and pull it faster than its nature will grow. Just the same as you. Don't force your children. Your job is to nurture your children, to let them grow, let them be, let nature happen, not to force it. You are on this journey of nature. It doesn't go according to your schedules, it goes according to nature's schedules. Some of you will meditate very successfully, very quickly, and you think, why me? Why have I grown so quickly? Just some flowers are like that, that's all. It doesn't make them better than others. Some people go more slowly. The ones who go fast into deep meditation or fast into enlightenment, they get very peaceful very quickly. They don't have much wisdom because they don't have much experience of the path on the way. It's like when you go on a journey and you go to the destination on a direct course. You know the destination, but you don't know too much about the journey. When you get lost down this side street, when you get lost down that side street, you know much about the path. That's why when people take me anywhere, I love it when they get lost. If they take me straight from the airport to Champaka Buddhist Lodge, I don't get to see anything of PJ or KL. But when they get lost, I get a free sightseeing tour. So when you get lost on the path of meditation, you learn a lot about the territory. And you become very wise. So even if it takes a long time, it doesn't matter. You learn a lot on the way. So that way you can look upon your meditation just like nurturing a flower, which is going to grow at its own rate according to cause and effect. If it grows slowly, you're going to become more wise. If you're going to grow quickly, you'll have less suffering. It doesn't really matter. Both ways you're a winner. And both ways you eventually take your place in the garden of enlightenment like everybody else. So your job is just to nurture, not to do the meditation. It happens despite you. In fact, the more you get out of the way, the quicker it happens. It's called letting go. So stop measuring your progress. Stop even measuring good or bad. When there's no good, when there's no bad. In the meditation, I'm not talking outside the meditation. I'm not telling you to give up your precepts. Not like that fellow who said, Ajahn Brahm, let go and have sex. Let go and take a glass of wine. Come on, let go, let go, let go. That's stupid letting go. But in the meditation, see how much you can abandon. Let go of control. And you'll find everything will get still and peaceful very quickly. This is how we meditate. This is how we get into deep states. This is how we see the Dhamma. This is how we become free and become enlightened. In life, we let go of things we can't change, just like Howard Macmillan. We let go of the past. We let go of what people say about us. We let go to be free and happy. In meditation, we let go even further, to be completely liberated. That's called the path of letting go. So, that finishes the talk for this evening. Now, are there any questions? Yeah, go on. I can let you go now if you want to go home. Any questions about this evening's talk? Or about anything else? It doesn't have to be about letting go. Any questions from upstairs? I can see you up there. Hi. You can wave. Are you waving? Yeah, you're waving. Thank you. Who's going to? Yes, the first question, yes. Can your heart open to the mind? Can Mara what? Can Mara do what? Mara, what opens to Mara? Open your heart to Mara. It's a bit dangerous. It's just like saying to the burglar, the door of my house is open to you. Yeah, I wouldn't do that if I was you. No. Sometimes, I think I see what you mean, is that if you forgive Mara loving kindness, compassion, then of course it's... Because compassion is the opposite of actually controlling. It's amazing just if you give kindness to other people. This is... You know that story where I got that saying, opening the door of your heart? It came from my father, who instead of wanting to control me, gave me loving kindness instead. And the reason he did that, I didn't tell the full story in the book, but many of you may know this story. The reason my father was such a loving man who told me when I was a 16-year-old, no, not 16, about 13-year-old boy, whatever you do in life, son, the door of my heart will always be open to you. It was because his upbringing was an upbringing of abuse. He was brought up in Liverpool, before the Second World War, when there was the Depression, the Great Depression, in not just the US, but throughout the whole of Europe. It was the time of the general strike in UK. Many, many people lost their jobs. And there was great poverty throughout everywhere at that time in the 30s. And so my paternal grandfather was a plumber in Liverpool. And it was such a dead-end job at that time that my paternal grandfather would come home every evening drunk, would take off his belt, and he'd whip any child who actually came close for no reason whatsoever. And having beaten the kids, then was set upon his wife, my paternal grandmother. Please excuse this language, but this is what my father would always say. He called his father, my paternal grandfather, a bastard. I need to say that because it tells you how my father viewed his physical abuse, his emotional abuse when he grew up. He hated that man. But every time he was on the end of a lashing, he reminded himself, or he made a determination, if ever I survive, if ever I have children, I will never do that to them. When he knew from personal experience how much it hurts, I mean not just the welts, I'm talking about the emotional, the hurt deep inside, he said, I'll never want to do that to anybody else. So when he managed to escape from that terrible situation after the Second World War, get settled down and marry my mother, he was the most kind and non-violent father you could ever want. Because my mother was a disciplinarian, my father just couldn't beat the kids. Instead, he was the most compassionate and kind man. What he'd actually learned from the abuse. It was horrendous when he described what happened to him. But instead of revisiting that abuse on my brother and myself, he turned it around, learned from it, and became so kind and so wonderful. So when people say they're abused as a child, either sexually or physically, it does not mean that you too have to be an abuser of others. If you can learn from it, like my father learned from it, to see what it's like and never want to do that to any other human being, you will actually take that abuse, like the truckloads of dung, and turn it into a beautiful garden, fertilizer for your life. So he's very loving and caring, and that was the reason why. So it was he who said to me, the door of my heart's always open to you, no matter what you ever do. He let me be, he let me go, he didn't try and control me at all. And because he didn't try and control me, because he gave me that freedom, I lived up to that freedom. He didn't actually try and make me a good scholar. Because he gave me such trust, I wanted to be a good son to him, someone he could be proud of. That's why I did well at school. When I say I went to Cambridge, I went just the ordinary, the local primary school, because my parents were poor. It was scholarships all the way. I had no privilege from a wealthy parents. I just won my way all the way to university. And if I became a good man and eventually a good monk, it was because my father let me be. He nurtured me rather than controlled me. He never put on this fast fertilizer which you try and give to your kids to make you grow faster than you should. He just nurtured and let me grow at my own rate. And that's why I love that man very much. And why I learned love, peace, and how that made me grow into who I am now. So always say that if you do let go, let the loved ones be. They will not get worse because you give them that freedom. They will actually get much better. More wise, learned, much better human beings because you give them that wonderful gift of freedom. It's the same with your loved ones, your husband and wife. If you really put them in a cage, then they will live like a prisoner. You will have no real relationship, but if you give them freedom, if you say, husband, wife, the door of my heart is open to you no matter what you ever do, and you really mean it, if you let them be, let them go, then they'll always be with you to the end of your days. Because who can resist such a very high spiritual freeing love? It's so rare, you would never throw that away. That's what I found. That's why loving kindness, that type of love, was the same for me as letting go. It was only years later when we had German monks at my monastery. they told me the German word for love is Liebe. That rang a lot of bells. If the German word for love is Liebe, then where do we get liberality from? Or liberation? Liebe, love, liberality, giving, liberation, freedom, all coming from the same spot. When you practice loving kindness, you are letting go. When you make donations, or even more than that, you forgive someone. You give the benefit of the doubt to another being. You forgive them. Give up your hatred. You give the benefit of the doubt to another being. You forgive them. Give up your hatred. That is called freedom. That is called love. Freedom, love, generosity, all the same word. So this is why letting go is nothing more than love. If you really love someone, you really let them go. So when they get so old, they're about to die, you know how much you love your father, your mother, your wife, or your husband. You know how much you love them by your ability to let them go, to free them. If you're grieving a wife or a husband, a son or a parent who's passed away, you're not loving them. You're not really grieving for them. You're grieving for yourself, for your own pain, not their pain. We never grieve for others, we grieve for ourselves, for our own hurt and pain. So real love is freeing. And this is an advice for you. If ever you are with a loved one in the last hours before they die, try and do this little ceremony called giving them permission to die. The first time I did this was in Perth, I don't know about how many years ago now, quite a long time ago now. I was counseling this young man, a Westerner, who was maybe about 33, 34, who was dying of cancer. He had his beautiful wife, Jenny. And I was in their little apartment, counseling them, trying to ease his physical pain from the death of his organs through cancer. He only had a day or two left. And as I was looking at them, I soon got an insight into what was going on and why he was taking so long for the final part of the journey into death. So I looked at his wife, Jenny, and I said, "Have you given him permission to die yet?" Given Steve, his name was. And Jenny looked at me. She realized I'd hit the nail on the head. She smiled. She never said anything back to me. She climbed on the bed, put her hands around Steve, looked him right in the eye, and said, "Steve, darling, I give you permission to die. It's all right, don't hang on for me." And the two of them embraced and cried while I was just looking on. That was a wonderful time in the last, what it turned out, few hours of his life. As soon as his wife gave him permission to die, he felt free. He could let go of his struggle and go gently and gracefully into death and beyond. And to this day, when I counsel people who are dying, I also look for the people who are holding them back, the loved ones. Because you know what it's like if it's a husband, a wife, a son, a parent who's about to go. You don't want them to go. You're sad at their parting. So sad you are actually thinking of yourself. Quite naturally, but that's what you're doing. So, in order to free them, because they're hanging on for you, they're in pain because you won't let them go. So it's marvelous, it's wonderful, it's an act of final love to get up on their bed and say, "Darling, husband, wife, respected parent, I give you permission to go." don't hang on for me. I let you go. It means that you allow them to release their mind from their decaying, dying body. And they can go so peacefully, so wonderfully. And it means afterwards, after they're dead, you've already done the first part of letting go. Letting them die. Now you can let them be cremated or be buried. You can let them go into their future life. Always remembering them, but never carrying them around to the point of grief, the point of sickness and stress. Too often we carry that dead person, we won't let them go. It means that we get sick with all sorts of diseases and cancers because we grieve a loved one. That we can't do our duties as a parent, as a child. We can't even do our business properly. Simply because we can't let them go. So love is letting them go. Selflessly, the time is up. Now is the time for you to go. And you go with my blessing. I don't mean that for you, I mean when somebody's dying. So that's how to deal with someone who's dying. And actually there's another little story on that. It's in the little book, you may remember this story, but it's a fascinating story. That also happened when there was one of our monks. When I was in Thailand, he was a Rhodes Scholar. Who became a monk. And then we get some great people becoming monks. Monks aren't losers. In fact, they're some of the most successful and even wealthy people, or sons of wealthy people, become monks. You know that, who's the richest person in Malaysia? What's his son called? Venerable Siripanyo. Yeah, he's at our monastery in Thailand. So he was at my monastery in Perth for a year. He's a great monk. Now his father is the richest person in Malaysia. He doesn't need to go to work on a Monday morning ever. He doesn't need to go on arms round begging for his food, but he does it every day. He doesn't need to live in a small hut in the jungle. He could have a big condominium all to himself. He doesn't need to be celibate. He could have a harem. But he's given it all up. Isn't that wonderful? So there's people who are doctors, PhDs, double MAs. It's amazing just the sort of people who become monks. They're not all losers. This was a Rhodes Scholar. He was a monk with me in Thailand. But he got sick. He got two strains of typhoid at the same time. Apparently, he told me that, I'm not sure if this is correct, doctors would tell me if it's right or wrong, there's only three strains of typhoid. He got two of them together. He's a very sick monk. He came very close to dying in Thailand. We sent him over to United Kingdom. We sent him to this monastery to try and look after him. We did not spare any expense. Every type of medicine, the ordinary medicine, homeopathy, allopathy, the only pathy we didn't give him was psychopathy. That's only a joke. Every type of medicine we gave him, but nothing worked. He just got sicker and sicker. And this was actually, he was living in this room in the attic of our monastery in Sussex for about 3 or 4 years. Could never get out of his room. On days he felt reasonably, the better days, he'd get out of his bed, walk to the door, that would exhaust him so much, he'd be back in the bed for the next few months. He was really one sick man. Very often on the edge of death, but never actually dying. And after 3 years of exhausting every possible means of treating this guy, the abbot of the monastery, a very wise monk, Ajahn Sumedho, he had this wonderful insight. He went up to this monk's room, and just the two of them. This person who was once a Rhodes Scholar, not only a great scholar, but also he was a champion wrestler as well. Very, very fit before, but now bedridden for about 3 years. He went up there into this dingy room, and he looked over the bed of this forlorn, thin, so weak monk. And he said to him, I've come up here on behalf of all of the monks and nuns in this monastery, and on behalf of all the lay men and lay women who support us, on behalf of all your friends and relations as well. I've come up on behalf of everybody to give you permission to die. You can die if you want. Don't try so hard to live. And again, it was one of those moments where you see so deeply, have so much insight into the nature of the problem, that this Rhodes scholar just started weeping. He cried and cried and cried. Inside, he was trying so hard to get better. He was trying so hard to survive when these people had tried so hard to cure him. That was what was making him sick. From that time on, when he was given permission to die, he started to get better. And he's still alive to this day. What brilliant psychology that was. You let it go. If you're going to die, die. And then you get better. It works. So that's what we mean by letting go. Because when you don't let it go, there's stress. I've got to get better. I've got to survive. Because my loved ones won't let me go. And that is what makes you sick. Too much sickness comes from trying to get well. You understand? Those of you who've been sick know what I'm talking about. Everyone who comes to visit you say, how are you feeling today? The most stupid question when you come and visit a sick person. And that makes you feel even worse because you have to lie. At least bend the truth. I'm feeling a little bit better today. What that means is you feel awful, but you don't want to tell them because it might upset them. So when you visit the sick, never talk to the sickness. Talk to the person. Don't ask them how they're doing today, because that's what the doctors and nurses ask them. That's what we call letting go. Any other questions? There's only one question. Can I get two today? Anything from up to the top there? Upstairs? You got a question? No. Okay. Any other question? Yes. Okay. Yeah. The answer to that, we say that you're praying in some parts they pray to the Gautama the Buddha, sometimes they pray to Amitabha Buddha, should you let go of one of those? The answer is you should let go of both of them. Because sometimes, when actually you pray to these things, that sometimes people actually ask, does that work? When you ask for favors from a Buddha, and actually the Buddha can't give you anything. But when actually you determine something, every psychologist knows that if you determine, you resolve upon something, then actually there's a chance you might get that. It's when you're praying to the Buddha, you're actually praying to yourself more than a lump of metal behind me. And when you, this is like motivational psychology. You may actually go to a top hotel, the Hilton, in KL somewhere, and you pay thousands of dollars to hear the same things you'll hear for free at Chempaka Buddhist Lodge on an evening when I'm here. So you're very smart coming here because it's cheap. But it's true that when you resolve upon something, you put it in your mind. I've already said it's called programming mindfulness. You're telling yourself what you want. You're teaching the mind what it needs to do, and very often it works, as long as it's a reasonable request. If it's not a reasonable request, of course it won't work. For example, some time ago, somebody actually made this request. There was this husband and wife, it was their 60th wedding anniversary. So they made this puja, this offering to the Buddha, and when they were actually, after doing this, they almost heard this voice of compassion, saying that, they heard it, whether it was from a deva or the Buddha, who knows, but it said that you've been doing so much good karma over all these 60 years. You've been married together for so long time, and both of you have been faithful. Because of that, whatever you wish, I will grant. And the woman actually said, she thought, we've worked so hard, but most of our money's gone on our children. And my husband still has to do his business. Can we become rich? Not very rich, but enough so we can retire, so my husband doesn't need to go to work. And straight away, like magic, she saw this big pile of cash next to her. She got her money so she could retire. And it was her husband's turn. What about you? And he said, well, now we've got enough money, but quite frankly, I'm a man. He said, I'm not an arahat. I'm not sort of enlightened. I'm not a monk. My wish is that I was married, that my wife, that I was married to someone who was 40 years younger than me, instead of my old wife. And so straight away his wish was granted. Instead of being 80, he was 120. That's a joke. So sometimes we wish for the wrong things. And if it's impossible, it can't be granted. So when actually you are making a determination in front of the Buddha, make sure it's a decent determination. Not just for yourself. So you're not really praying to the Buddha to become wealthy, but you're praying to the Buddha to be happy in a good way, in a noble way, in a wise way, to be peaceful, to be content, rather than just to have worldly happiness. Because the Buddha is an unworldly person, so it could only give you unworldly things. Yeah, go on. Go on, yeah? Okay, you're saying of the three major traditions, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana, and the Theravada, that we've got the least amount of rites and rituals. We do the least amount of chanting, because that's because most of us monks are too lazy to learn all the chanting. No, because those rites and rituals, they have developed over the centuries. So originally there were very, very few rituals and rites. Maybe now and again we develop new ones, like the chicken ritual, for actually getting words back into your mouth, rotten words you said. But they're all there for a meaning. So we try and keep the rituals less and less, and to keep the meaning more and more. So sometimes we do these rituals, but do you understand exactly what they're doing, what it means? Sometimes we do all these rituals. For example, I found out that in one part of Vajrayana, they do this black hat ceremony. And apparently the black hat from this holiness of Karmapa, all it was a crown, which was given by one of the Mughal emperors, because the Dalai Lama and the Karmapa were vying for actually being the leader of the Tibetan kingdom. And one of them, they put all of their support on one of the Mughal emperors. The other one put it on the other one. They were going to have a battle. The Dalai Lama's, the one the Dalai Lama supported won. The one the Karmapa supported lost, which meant the Dalai Lama became the head of Tibet. But the crown which the Karmapa was to wear was called the black cat. And they make that a religious ceremony, even though it was secular in nature. So sometimes we have all these ceremonies and they get too much because we lost their meaning. Ceremonies are all right. They're important if we can remember their meaning. So it's the same as like the funeral ceremony. Sometimes we spend thousands of dollars on funeral ceremonies, not really realizing what they mean. We don't need to do that. What happens is, because you don't know what they mean, because the person next door spent $10,000 on their father's funeral, you've got to spend $11,000. Otherwise you don't love your father, so you think. But it's not necessary at all. When you come to Buddhism, the ceremonies should be able to be explained. So the funeral ceremony, for example, is there for the person who's passed away to teach them Dhamma because they're still around, and it's also there for the people left behind to teach them how to deal with death, how to deal with life. I've always noticed at a funeral ceremony, everybody is listening. They pay attention at that time. It's the same with a marriage ceremony. The reason we have a marriage ceremony is actually to make that commitment more real. When a boy and a girl just live together, when they don't make their commitment public in front of their relations and friends, it's not so meaningful. They don't tend to survive in their relationship so well. So that's why we have a marriage ceremony, to make sure that they stick together a little bit longer than they would do otherwise. And that's why that when I give my marriage ceremonies, they really stick together, because I tell all those stories, the chicken and duck story, about the, you know, commitment. You all know the story about commitment, that being involved as a boy and a girl just going out together, that's just involvement. When you get married, it's commitment. You know that story, the difference between bacon and eggs? Being just boyfriend and girlfriend, even just being engaged, is only involvement. When you get married, it's called commitment. The difference between involvement and commitment is the difference between bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, think about it. In bacon and eggs, the pig is committed. The chicken is only involved. So I can't do this in Muslim marriages, but in in Buddhist marriage, I say, let it be a pig marriage. You give everything. You give your life for that marriage, not just one little egg. So when I do those ceremonies, you make them meaningful, and because you make them meaningful, it means those people which I marry, the ones whose ceremonies I do, they don't come and bother me later on. Because they're happily married. Isn't that wonderful? So there is a reason for ceremonies, but they should be done meaningfully. Okay? Yeah, go on. One last question. There we go. Here you go. There's a circular white light on his chest. Yeah. It must be actually the sort of, when he goes back to his room, must be his headlights. What is it? Sorry? Bidevas? I haven't seen that photograph, but it might be sort of, it could be one of two things. It could be actually deva lights, a supernatural thing, or it could be digital enhancing. No, 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 because I haven't seen it yet. But you know of all the supernatural powers which you can have, like seeing devas, hearing deva music, being able to float through the air, being able to read people's minds. You know of all those supernatural powers. You know what the Buddha said, the only psychic power which he thinks is worthwhile showing other people The only psychic power which the Buddha approved of, you know what that was? The psychic power of teaching the Dhamma. So, today you've seen the psychic power. So may you all go back home and have a wonderful evening. Okay, so let's share merits now. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And a talk tomorrow night is the jhanas. So those who want to hear about really interesting stuff of the mind, jhanas is coming tomorrow.